Hey there, Freedom Fighters. My name is Andrew Warner. I'm the founder of Mixergy, where today's guest has reminded me I've been doing this for 10 years. And I remember interviewing his co-founder years ago. Let me introduce him. Ahmad Akund. Ahmad Akund. I'm pronouncing your last name right?
Yeah, Akund. Thanks for having me, Andrew.
Thanks for being on here. Dude, I remember interviewing your co-founder years ago about HeyZap and getting so freaking sucked into the games on the site that I couldn't stop. Mm-hmm. And then it feels like you guys pivoted the company. You became an ad-serving tech company, and you sold for, what, $54 million? Am I right?
45.
45. I had it wrong.
Yeah, it was a long journey. Should I walk you through that journey?
We'll go through it within this interview. I just want to set this up. So then the other thing that happened was we somehow had an interview set up, and I said, I want to get to know Ahmad's new company. So I tweeted out, hey, does anyone know about Mercury? It's a brand new bank. He set it up. And I'll be honest with you, Ahmad. I really like you. I was looking for negative stories. Not because I want to like aha you in the face, but I feel it comes across really sad when the whole interview is, this is amazing. This is great. Come on. Look at you, big boy. You did it. Right? But I couldn't find any negative stuff. And I'm telling you, I talked to dozens of your customers who are using Mercury Bank. And these are people who are very tech savvy. They don't look for the first bank option. They want to make sure that they get the right thing. They showed me how your software works. They showed me why they're with Mercury. It makes sense. Now I want to switch to Mercury. You asked me why I hadn't, what it's going to take. I'll tell you in the interview. We're going to find out about Mercury. We're going to find out about HeyZap. We're going to find out about what happened. Did you have a private life after HeyZap? Did you have fun? I'm going to find out about your investments. I know you've got a rolling fund with AngelList. I talked to AngelList, you know, for understanding of how these rolling funds work and what I'm allowed to say and what I can't. I'm going to find out all about your business thanks to two phenomenal sponsors. The first, for anyone who's launching a company, you've got to check out LaunchPeer. They will help you by building your first version. And the second company is TopTal. If you're hiring phenomenal developers, or Ahmad, if your companies are hiring developers, you should go to TopTal. But first, Ahmad, good to have you here.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Andrew.
Do you remember the day that you sold HeyZap? Let's take it to that moment for a bit.
That's funny. You know, often it's hard to describe it to people sometimes, like, a lot of things that like are successful in a startup take so long before you get there, right? Like we were talking with acquirers for a good 10 months before the acquisition happened. So like I very distinctly remember when it happened. It was actually a painful process getting through the acquisition. But you know, it was at such a long time that it's often not as celebratory as you think it might be.
Was there a moment of relief, 10 months of talking to people? Was there a moment where you go, okay.
It's mixed, you know, especially when acquisitions, because you've been working on this, like we were doing HeyZap for 8 years. We started in 2008. So, and then it's hard when you're like, yeah, there's obviously the positive side of it. You get money and yeah, you see a home for the company and the employees and stuff, but it's also hard when you're like, okay, there's uncertainty. You don't know what you're getting into. And, so yeah, it's in a way it should be all positive, but it was definitely mixed.
How much did you get to keep from that? Let's be open.
not that much. It was sub 5 million.
Okay. Over 3?
A bit more.
Okay. And so you got to invest, the investments that you made, and I see dozens of companies. I think it was over 50 companies on AngelList. Am I right?
150 now.
150. Those investments are your money up until recently, right?
No. So I've been doing something mostly on AngelList. I've been doing like some form of like fund syndicates, a bunch of different things. So early on it's basically in 2016, I was investing quite a lot of my own money. But since 2016, like 17 onwards, it's been funds or other things on AngelList. So the rolling fund is like my newest thing I'm doing on AngelList.
And the thing that they did with you before, this was 2015, I think, that you sold your company. Am I right?
Start of 2016, yeah.
Start of 2016. So the thing that you were doing before was one of them where AngelList will find a Y Combinator alumni, get them some money, and then since you know Y Combinator, you have access, you can pick the company to invest in. Is that one of the things that you did?
Yeah, so I've been a YC fund lead. I've done that 8 times, so since basically 2016 onwards. So a lot of my investments are YC companies. I mean, I would do that anyway because, you know, I've done Y Combinator twice and I was a part-time partner there. So it's something that I understand, and I think great companies come from there.
What kind of access and understanding do you have when you're investing that's unique to you that makes it, what do you have that other people don't?
I think there's a bunch of factors. It's just, it's easier when you really understand what the other person's going through. So like, I mean, there's some like logistic things, like you don't want to be talking to a YC company after 1 month of them being in YC because they're like heads down trying to build something. They're trying to make as much progress as possible. So there's a timing thing, like you want to talk to them like 2 weeks before demo day. That's when people are like sticking their heads up and thinking about investment. There's also like, you know, whether they respond to you, like when I email them, I'm like, hey, I've done YC twice, you know, I'm an entrepreneur, you know, maybe yeah, I can invest, I've done these things. Like they're much more likely to respond to that. And on the other side, I'm just much more friendly, right? Like I try to be honest with them, and I try to be helpful with them. So that's kind of quid pro quo. And then the last thing is there's a whole lot of YC alumni that now invest in YC companies. Like almost every seed or series ABC has a YC alumni. And a lot of them are like alumni from around when I did YC, which was 2007 and 2009. So we know each other and we share deals with each other and all that stuff. So that's helpful too.
Got it. And so you've got a sense of who's what because they, how the different entrepreneurs are because your friends are investing or talking to them.
Yeah. I mean, I just don't have the time to evaluate like all 200 YC companies. Whereas, you know, some of these guys do it full time. So if they're like, oh, this company's great, I invested. That's a massive vote of confidence from my perspective.
What's your biggest win here?
Biggest one's Rappi so far. It's a Postmates for Latin America. They're actually huge. Many people in the US don't know them, but they basically like a combination of Instacart and Postmates in Latin America. So I did the seed round before, like while they were in YC. And now they, like their last round was a SoftBank round for like $3 billion valuation.
I remember when I was in South America, I think even in Mexico, they're everywhere. Their couriers are everywhere with those big boxes on their backs.
Yeah. Well, I've done a bunch of other good ones. Substack was one I did the seed round in, and Airtable and Rippling. But yeah, there's a lot of good ones in the 150.
Did you get to do anything especially fun after you sold HeyZap?
I'm a kind of a boring person. Like I'm just very like, I just like startups. And so like I went very deep in investing. I like talking to entrepreneurs. Actually, it's really fun. I mean, you do this, so you know how it feels, but it's just like spend 1 hour with someone who's like trying to do something new and they have this like deep understanding of what they know. And they basically teach you for 1 hour. I think it's like super fun. Like I can't think of that many more fun things to do. After I sold, I had 1 year at the company that bought us. And then I was supposed to take a year off. I kind of took something like 7 months off, but I didn't really take any time off until I left San Francisco and we went to Europe. And you know, spend some time with family there and other stuff. And that's when I really like switched off. I can't sit still. So like, and I like talking to entrepreneurs. So I did a bunch of that. And I did a bunch of kind of work setting up Mercury.
In getting Europe?
Ready. Sorry?
In Europe, you did a bunch of work?
No, this is
afterwards. So when you're in Europe for fun, what kind of things did you get to do?
Oh, we just traveled. So I have two kids and we just went to Italy. And
you take a nanny with you?
No.
Wow, that's a lot of work to take two kids through Europe without a nanny. You're basically not getting to enjoy it.
Yeah, but like spending time with kids is like part of the fun, right?
My wife is big on, she'll just go on to some service and she'll bring in a babysitter. I don't feel comfortable doing that.
Yeah.
You do that?
I find that awkward as well. Like I want to, yeah, I think, yeah, I never considered like spending time with kids as work personally. Like I think like, even startup things, right? Like a lot of the enjoyment comes from the work aspect, right? Like you can't just like, you got to like enjoy the journey. You can't just like expect like some of the positive moments alone. So yeah, I enjoy it.
I get it. I'm with you. I like the screaming. I like when they're arguing, even when they're like, they're pissed at me. I can't stop smiling. I have to turn my back sometimes. Cause it's just, it's like this little kid is angry at me. You're 3 years old. What are you angry about? But at the same time, I do want some space for me and Olivia to just go walk through a new city, explore, sit at a coffee shop for 2 hours and do nothing but stare, right? Kids aren't big on that. What was the difference then? So you guys started HeyZap. It was a collection of games. It was 320,000 sites. So it was really distributed to even more than that. Last time I talked to your co-founder, Jude, it was that many.
Yeah.
And then at some point you changed. Can you help me understand what led to the transition and what happened?
Sure. We actually did four pivots. So we started in 2008 with this concept, which is Flash Games Distribution. And that worked pretty well. Like, we had, you know, a few hundred thousand websites. We raised money from Union Square Ventures. So it was working, but it was overshadowed by the fact that, like, Flash games were dying, right? So this is 2009. You know, iPhones were around, but they weren't that huge yet. But by the time 2010 came, you know, all of this kind of, it's interesting. Like, there's a demand side of it, which completely shifted, right? Like, everyone wanted to play mobile games and not Flash games and games on the website. And then also the creative kind of supply side of it, all of the game creators switched to mobile as well, because that's where the demand was. And it was you could make novel games then. So we were seeing this trend, and it was very hard to see a future where Flash games will continue to be big. And I mean, now it's a foregone conclusion, but in 2010, it wasn't. So we shifted. So we're like, okay, we have to do this on mobile. We still had a bunch of money from investors, so it wasn't like we were going to give up. So we basically, we pretty much had acquisition offer then as well, but we were like, okay, you know, we don't want to sell out. We want to keep going. So we basically launched a social network for mobile gamers in 2011. So that's pivot number one.
Okay.
And that was actually, you know, we're pretty good at selling things and persuading people to, like, use things we made. So we got a bunch of game developers to, like, promote this kind of, I don't know if you remember, like, Foursquare did this, like, check-in thing. And we had this check-in mechanic, so you could check into mobile games.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay.
And it was, in 2011, it was in a lot of casual games, especially on Android. So we got a ton of users, about 10 million users. But
Can I pause for a moment before we talk about the transition? You got a lot of websites to have your Flash, to host your Flash games. You got a lot of game developers to include your check-in mechanism. How? What do you do to get so many people to trust you, to embed you? What is it?
I mean, a lot of it just comes down to, like consistent sales and having a process. So, I mean, if you talk about mobile games, like, we built a whole, I think, one of the things we did, which was unusual a little bit, is we were willing to put, like, engineering behind sales. So we built a whole scraper that would scrape both Android and iOS app store. And it wouldn't just, like, say, here's the top 100. It would also look for, like, the delta. So every week it would scrape and say, oh, it looks like this game jumped from, like, position 2000 to, like, position 1500. Okay. And we would literally go all the way to, like, position 2000. I mean, nowadays you can kind of do some of this stuff with App Annie or whatever. But we built all of these scrapers from scratch, and we basically had, like, I think 3 to 5. I can't remember exactly how much in 2011, but, like, we had, like, 5-ish salespeople, and we would allocate these out. We'd be like, this tiny game no one's heard of is, like, growing in the charts. Go hunt that person down. And they would Twitter them whatever it took. And then,
that's really you coming up with these mechanisms today, like what you're talking about. It's fairly common, and it's a lot of times fully automated.
Yeah.
But at the time, was that you coming up with the idea? Where do you come up with this whole process?
Yeah, I'm an engineer. So, like, I apply engineering to and, like, productizing things as to as much things as possible. And I wasn't like trained for sales or something. It was just kind of very much like, okay, we need to get these people. How do we get them? How do we make a pipeline for sales? And, like, just, you know, we built these things out. And
do you go back to it? Is there a framework that you use? Is it something like, I imagine watching you, that part of it is you thinking, if I was trying to get one person, what's the process I would go through? How would I find the right person to contact? How would I get their contact information, et cetera? Does this scale to multiple people? Yes, it would. Well, I wouldn't want to scale it to multiple people. What part of it can I automate to scale to reach out to multiple people? And is that your process for coming up with this sales system?
I actually think it's like, you want to, like, throw a bunch of creative people at a problem like that. So it wasn't just me. We actually hired salespeople that weren't usually sales. Like, our top salesperson was, like, a full-time poker gambler for 2 years. And he had, like, you know, and if you can make money being a full-time poker gambler, like, you're pretty good at kind of figuring things out and you have a lot of grit. So we hired, like, these, like, relatively young and experienced salespeople, and we would go, okay, you have to hit this many. Like, we would do it based on, like, installs for the app. So we'd be like, you have to hit this many installs. So a lot of these things were worked out by them.
Got it.
And then I combine that with like meet every, you know, twice a week and say, okay, you know, how can we get this better? And if they were like, okay, you know, it's working really well in this category, we allocate more things around that. So it was a combination of kind of just being creative about it and not having like too many rules about things you couldn't do, and being willing to like spend engineering time on it.
Okay. So that was the next thing. What happened after that?
Right. So that didn't work. We got a bunch of installs, but people just wouldn't stick around. And like, you know, you see these retention graphs. I don't know if you've seen them, but basically like the way they're supposed to go is like, yeah, after 1 month, like maybe 30% of people are there. After 2 months, 20%, and then it levels off or like starts growing again. And our retention graph was like a freaking straight line down to zero. It's just no matter what we did, 6 months later, we just could not get them to like stick around. I think we'd figured out this distribution mechanic. But there wasn't a strong enough reason for people to stick around. And we tried everything. Like we tried leaderboards inside the app. We spent 2 years basically like launching things every 3 months that were like really focused on retention because we had the distribution down. So we were like, we could see like people would just stop using. And we asked them, why have you stopped using it? They would like, by far the biggest category was always it's taking up too much disk space or battery. Which is basically like this universal thing that like, it's just not useful.
it's kind of like when people tell me I don't have enough time or I don't have enough money for a membership. Yeah. It's an easy answer, but it doesn't explain why this isn't worth your time, why it's not worth your money, or in your case, why it's not worth their battery.
Yeah. So, okay. Yeah. Potentially like this whole idea of like vertical social networks, which was like kind of big back then, just isn't a thing. I mean, even now there isn't really a gaming focused social network. So I just think it wasn't an idea that really engaged people.
Let me pause again. I keep coming to understand you as a person in addition to the businesses that you ran. As a person, how do you not get just depleted 2 years, month after month, trial after trial, failing, 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 failing? How do you keep yourself going and not feel like, man, I can't make it?
You know, I think it's as long as you have like ideas and you can make things, like I think that's fun. Like there was definitely times within that I was like, okay, you know, are we just wasting our time? But I always had like, okay, what else can we do? What's like, you know, just making something and trying to like fix this like problem was like kind of engaging. And there's types of things that are hard. Like I think raising money from investors is hard. And like, I think we tried to raise money during this time period. And, you know, we just like, at the end of the day, investors are like fairly good at reading these graphs and they could see the retention wasn't there, even if the users were. And that was hard. Like, it's always hard to like, you know, when you're struggling with money and you've got employees to pay and you can't raise money, that's always like challenging. And you know, I wouldn't downplay that. But when it comes to, you know, trying to solve something, build some products, I think that like by itself, the journey is like kind of fun.
Did you have anything else going on the side that made you believe in yourself, that made you see progress and success?
Not particularly.
No. So there was no exercise. Was it angel investing that was starting to do well at that point for you or nothing like that?
I didn't start angel investing until 2016. So I was fully focused on this.
So this is just you saying, this is a problem. It's a challenge. I feel I'll just keep trying. As long as I've got ideas, I believe in each new idea, we'll figure this out.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Okay. All right. So then what happened next?
Okay. So that retention thing wasn't working. And then this was a funny time. So, you know, mobile ads were becoming a big thing back then. So we had this game company. It was called DNA, D-E-N-A. It's a big Japanese social company. So they were trying to break into the U.S. market. They, you know, actually, we had a salesperson who kind of led this up. And she literally, like, turned up with a 60K check from them. Right? This is, like, our first significant revenue we'd made as a company after, like, 4 or 5 years or something. A 60K check from them, and they were just like drive installs to us. And they didn't like, it was no attribution, nothing attached to the 60K. It was like, here's 60K, like, yeah, drive installs to us and tell us.
Because
like,
they just needed new installations in the US.
Yeah, they were just like, and back then, like, you know, it was a wild west of like kind of mobile ads. So we were like, wow, that's like 60K. That's like, you know, a significant chunk of revenue. And we did that with a few other people. Zynga paid us money. And we were like, okay, you know, we've got all of the users, but they don't stick around. But we also have all of these game developers that are putting in our check-in button. Could we also sell them these ads, because we have these advertisers that are willing to pay for it? And at that point, we were like very close to running out of money. So we went to our investors and we said, hey, we think this could work. You know, give us $1 million and 6 months, and like maybe we can like turn this into like actual like profitable company. And this is crazy because, you know, I thought everyone's going to leave the company because it's just, you know, we're doing another pivot. This is like our third full pivot pretty much.
Another thing that Imad believes in.
Sorry?
Right. Another thing that you believe in after 2 years of you believing in things that didn't work out. Okay. Yeah. But instead,
we kind of changed strategy a little bit. And, you know, we decided to be super transparent with everyone. And we were just like, hey, we have to get profitable. It's going to take 6 months. Hopefully we'll do it. This is the plan. And we've got $1 million extra. So we have runway. I don't even remember how much runway, but it wasn't long. It was like 9 months runway, maybe. And really surprisingly, like most of the employees stuck around. Pretty much everyone stuck around. Like all the engineers stuck around. All the salespeople stuck around. And we did it. Yeah, it was like we managed to get into some like pretty big games as like the kind of, I think pretty much like exclusive ad network at the time. And we managed to get a bunch of advertisers. And I think we needed to get to around like 150K in monthly revenue to be profitable. And we managed to do it in like 6 months. Which,
wow. Yeah, because companies were willing to pay for installs. And we'd seen that that did become a real value.
Yeah. And we managed to, like, we had a great designer back then. His name is Meng. And he came up with actually a fairly unique kind of ad, which then got copied by the whole industry. So if you ever see like this like full screen interstitial ad, which is like interrupts you, but it's like very high and like it said the graphics of the game and it's got like an install button. He was, as far as I know, he was the first person to come up with that. But you know, having that like relatively unique kind of thing where it was like well designed, that also appealed to game developers because they didn't want like, you know, ugly things in their game ruining the experience. So at least, again, it was kind of Android focused because, you know, we'd done well up to then with game developers on Android. And that was also, back then, everyone was like very iOS focused when it came to advertising. So we were able to win like a lot of market share there.
Why did you go through 10 months of selling? What was it that made you say it's time for us to let go of this company?
You know, ever since we got into the ad stuff, it was never something that I wanted to do, right? Like, I think the game stuff, like, you know, distributing games, working with game developers, like, that was kind of exciting to me. I've always played games. But the ad tech side, it was something we kind of accidentally fell in and, like, as partly out of necessity. And we were thinking of selling for, like, multiple years, and we'd had discussions with multiple people. We'd actually stopped talking to acquirers because we were doing something new. So there was actually this last pivot that we haven't touched on, which is we went switched from like just being an ad network to being a developer tool where we would like indie app developer would put HazeApp in and we would figure out like what's the best ad to show right now. Is it a Facebook ad? Is it a Google ad? Is it
Okay.
It's called mobile mediation. So we just switched to that and we were quite excited about it because this was, Mopub was this big company that was sold for like $400 million to Twitter doing this exact thing. And it kind of, you know, after it was sold, it wasn't like given a lot of attention. So we thought it was a big space. We wanted to do it. Yeah. So we actually shifted to that. And at that point we were like, forget these acquirers, you know, there's no point in wasting time on them. And then as soon as that started doing well, then we had this acquirer kind of come to us, and they, you know, we were like, okay, are you serious? Like, we're like, you know, we don't have time for you, et cetera. But they were quite persistent. And then we were like, okay, what's the price? And they named the price. And I was like, oh, okay, that's kind of interesting. So we started entertaining that acquirer. And then we talked to another acquirer who, so that one didn't acquire us. In the end, we talked to a second company that did end up acquiring us called Fiber, which is at the time was a public German company. The reason it takes a long time, I mean, there's this initial part where there's this like initial dance of like figuring out what's the price and like all of that stuff. That took a long time. Like the first acquirer took a really long time doing due diligence and like giving us an offer. And then we managed to parlay that into a second offer from the second company. But yeah, it was a long process. It was, I think even that part was like 3 or 4 months. And then after you get that acquisition offer, like it's called a term sheet or LOI. Actually, I think it's normally called LOI. Then you have to do all the extra due diligence where they like literally look at your books, look at all the paperwork. So that was going on, and there was like in the middle of that, we had 1 month where we had bad numbers. So we'd been growing like very consistently, and then I distinctly remember this, it was October. We fell by like 5% instead of previously we were growing by like fairly consistent, like maybe 15% or something. And they were like, okay, you guys fell by 5%. You know, it's not working. Like, we want to renegotiate this deal. This is like 6 months into it, like renegotiating the deal. And that like prolonged the process by another 3 months, because then we ended up renegotiating the whole thing and we wanted extra protection. And then actually November was this huge growth month, but obviously by then like we were deep in this renegotiation. So having a good growth month probably helped like finally close the deal. So we ended up signing it, getting everything confirmed like the day before Christmas or something.
And you're not freaking out as a person. You're not worried. You're not, what's going on with my life? Things are in disarray. None of that goes in your head.
No, there was definitely a little bit of that. Like, you know, once you've like signed that deal, you're fairly committed and you've started imagining what your life is like afterwards.
And then it goes away, right?
Yeah, and you're like worried that's going to fall apart. So there's definitely a little bit of that. And yeah, I actually think like partly it might have been better to have someone impartial be the negotiator, because you do get, as a founder, like there's so much kind of on it for you. You know, it's like,
yeah,
like at that point, I had like basically zero net wealth apart from like this one thing that might come out of this.
You feel that acquirers know that?
Yeah,
no, right. They know that they give it to you, and then if they take it away, it's so painful. It's worse than if they'd never given you the option, the opportunity in the first place, right?
Yeah, they can definitely be a lot less kind of passionate about it. I mean, the other thing that's tricky about acquisition stuff is there's not that many examples of other entrepreneurs you can talk to about it. Like with Series A financing, you know, there's tons of entrepreneurs that will talk to you about it. But acquisition stuff, yeah, I don't know that many people who've been acquired, and everyone's acquisition stories are so different. So you don't have like necessarily that peer support network that can help you through it. Mm.
Who do you talk to at that point? Who is your person?
We had a kind of an investment banker person who was actually quite helpful and helping us guide us. Apart from that, you know, we've always had a fairly supported, we were funded by Union Square Ventures, and they're very founder friendly and supportive.
And so were you able to pick up the phone and talk to the partner there and say, this is what's going on, and have them reassure you, give them, they've had years of experience.
Yeah. They were helpful through that.
Okay. All right. Let me talk about my first sponsor, and then I want to come back and find out about a little bit of your time at Y Combinator right after you left, right? You spent about a year as a part-time founder at Y Combinator. Anyway. My first sponsor is a company called LaunchPeer. They basically build companies with developers. Their ideal is equity-free online incubation programs for non-technical founders. I want to tell you about one of their companies. Do you know Gotcha Group?
No.
I never heard of them either. And I was, again, like everything else, I get suspicious. Are they a real thing or not? Because their idea was they were going to become the Uber of college campuses. They're going to do scooters, cars, everything that you need, right? Some of these like whacked out cars, they've got them on college campuses. And of course, college kids are into it. And they've got a confined environment so they could test this stuff. Well, the founders of the company had this idea that they could provide these mobility options on campuses, that college students would be more open to it, that they could partner with a university and then roll it out throughout the university and give students options for getting around. And so they started hiring companies to build it. And the first company that they hired wasn't doing a good job. And then things were taking too long and they were just getting fed up. Meanwhile, they were selling. They got universities to say, yes, we're interested. But the software wasn't there. So after failing a bunch, they finally went to LaunchPeer and they said, look, we need a first version. And it can't just be a phone version for iOS and we'll roll it out slowly. It needs to be on all these different devices, because students have different devices. And if we're going to serve them all, it has to serve them all. We need an admin panel for the university in order for them to sit at a web page and manage it and all that. And LaunchPeer said, okay, we could do it. They went through a 12-week development timeline. They worked in 2-week sprints. They gave Gotcha demos at the end of each sprint, and throughout they stayed in touch via Slack, and Gotcha had something that worked. As a result, Gotcha was able to pitch colleges, and they knew that they had something worth testing. Gotcha ended up rolling out to Washington State University, Vanderbilt University, Florida State University, a whole bunch of other universities that now have this on campus. And so the reason I'm bringing this up is that's what Launchpeer does. They help companies, especially non-technical co-founders, get their product out there. And if you're ready to hire them, they're there for you. But if you're at a point where you say, I'm not sure I'm ready to hire them, I'm not sure if we have a product market fit, if I have an idea that actually has that makes sense, they've got a free program for anyone who's listening that will help you figure out if you've got a business that makes sense, that will walk you through how to create the first product, how to get people interested in it, how to know if you've got something that actually will sell. And they're going to give it away for you, give away to everyone at Mixergy for free. Here it is. If you go to launchpeer.com/Mixergy, you'll get it. That's launch, you know, like I'm going to help you launch. And then peer, because they're going to be your peer, your pal, your connection, your equal in this weight of getting things started. Go to launchpeer.com/Mixergy. Take that free course. They don't have an upsell. They're not in the info product business. They just say, hey, look, when you're ready to work with us, we'll be there to help you build that business. launchpeer.com/Mixergy. You know, I remember when you and I did that interview about 10 years ago, it was you and two other Y Combinator companies. And I remember I was using one of my listeners, I can't remember what it was, like Tweet Chat or something to record it because I wanted to support and he had a good product. And the recording didn't work out. And I remember apologizing to you guys so much that we'd have to re-record it. And I said, I owe you one. And because I said, I owe you one, which is like a whacked out thing to say. Who says this? It was not like we're in like the real estate business of the mob where now we owe, but I said it. And on my head, I keep thinking, I owe you one. I can't let it go until I give it. You know what I mean?
Sure.
Do you even remember that I owe you one?
I don't like
that. What? You don't remember that at all, right? Of course you don't, because you're not a psycho. It was the founder of Posterous. I remember feeling especially like a sense of debt to him for some reason. I'm not sure why. Anyway, back to Y Combinator. You then go and you become a part-time partner there. How do you help companies? What's the thing that you were able to add to them?
Good question. I think there's kind of specific things you can help people with if you really understand the industry or whatever. Like if they were struggling with retention in a social app, I know all about that. And there's like more generic things that are useful to everyone. So like fundraising advice, how to build a sales team, like all of these things. So I think most of the time you focus on the generically useful things. You know, I've been, I guess by that stage, successfully and unsuccessfully raised money many times. So hopefully I knew like the good things and bad ways of doing that. And then I had, you know, if it was ad tech or games or social, I had like a lot of kind of industry specific experience that I tried to be helpful with.
Are you a systemized person to the point where you might even have a doc with the steps that you take to raise money? Are you the person who's got a process written down like that?
Not like super specifically. I do quite a few of these like tweet storms where I try to like write out my process every now and then. And those are kind of useful. But you know, when you've done things lots of times, you obviously have built up a process, even if it's not like fully systematic. But when it comes to fundraising, like, you know, actually running a pipeline, I write every time I've ever done a fundraise, you've got to write down a pipeline, all the people you're going to hit up, who you're going to get introductions from.
You mean you write it down on what, in a spreadsheet or let's say Airtable? You do.
Spreadsheet right now, but
it's just a list of who's everybody that I know who I can go and raise from.
Yeah.
Okay. And do you go into your email or anything like that, or is it just top of mind?
Mostly top of mind.
Put it in a list. Okay.
Yeah. I guess, I mean, you start off with like people that you know, right? That's like step one. Then there's like people that are well known that you would like to get. And, you know, actually, like Y Combinator has like a pretty good investor database, which is always like a useful thing. You can see all the companies.
So you go in the database and you say, who do I know? Who feels like a good fit? I'll just add them to my list. Okay.
The other thing that, you know, the 7 months when I was kind of investigating setting up Mercury, I spent a lot of time like you basically have to like do pre-research kind of thing. Like you're like, okay, like you talk to the people that you know and you're like, okay, who do you know that you think would be interested in this? I think that's actually like super useful. And then, you know, maybe you talk to them straight away. Maybe you just put their name down in the list and say, okay, you know, I know if I ever need to get to Index Ventures or something. Like, this guy was funded by them and he knows them very well, so I'm going to put that in my list.
And it's just on a spreadsheet? It's not even anything more sophisticated than that?
I think for investor like fundraising, you don't want to have like 5,000 people in there. Like, you want like 50 to 100 people. That's
still, like, I think I would like to use something that's a little bit more of a database so that I can remember, so that I can write better notes. It's shocking how much people still use databases like that, but I would use Pipedrive or Airtable lets you set up, a Kanban board with cells for everyone. You're smiling at this. It makes sense, but not your process. You want it simpler than that. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I think whatever works for someone, for people, the most important thing is to have a process.
Okay. All right. So that's the first part of your process. You make this list. What's the next part of your process?
So fundraising, I think then, so what I like to do is personally like write a deck. No, everyone loves that. And I like practicing it quite a few times. So
with a friend or something?
With myself. Yeah, with other entrepreneurs. Okay. You want people who are going to be like a little critical of it. They're going to ask you questions. They're going to make you go, okay, you know, what happens if an investor asks me this question? How will I answer it? That kind of thing. And I mean, even before you get to any of that, like, you want to get to a stage where you are investable, right? Like, the tricky thing with Mercury was I can't make a bank without raising money. And then when I raise money, it's going to take me a long time. Like, we raised money in August 2017, but we didn't launch until April 2019. So at that stage, you might just say, okay, you know, I can't make any progress. I'm just going to write a deck and see if someone will give me money. But I don't think that's like a good way to go about it. So you want to basically de-risk as much as possible. I worked with our designer from HazeApp to make a bunch of mocks and like just, you know, realize the vision into like what an actual design would look like. So that was one way to de-risk it. Another way was I worked with, there's this guy called Daniel Kimmerling who did a company called Standard Treasury. He's a great guy who's now a fintech investor. But he had previously basically done a company that was kind of trying to make a bank, and he sold his bank to SVB, which is our main kind of competitor. So I worked with him quite a bit before that point. I had him down as an advisor so that when I went to an investor, there was like, it wasn't just like Imad, who knows nothing about like setting up a bank trying to do this. It was also, you know, these other people that like added some gravitas to the pitch that I could say, okay, you know, there's other people that have given me some confidence.
And what was his connection to you? It looks like he's a Y Combinator company right? Standard Treasury was. But was he then just an advisor? Was he an investor at that point or just a buddy of yours?
You know, one of the best things about entrepreneurs, especially if you're like trying to do something that they find interesting, is they're just like very free with advice. And like, you know, him and his co-founder just helped a lot.
Without asking for anything. And then investors didn't say, why are you bringing a buddy of yours who knows we should be investing in your buddy instead of in you?
He wasn't doing the startup, but yeah, he'd just been like super helpful. And actually, okay. I actually really wanted to give them advisory shares and they ended up not taking it because they were setting up a VC fund. And I don't really know why they didn't take it. They should have really. I want to give back to people who are useful to me. So they were just like very friendly and helpful people. But it was very important because, you know, when you're entering this like new space, which fintech was like pretty new to me, it's useful to have people who can like really answer the dumb questions and like over and over again, And like entrepreneurs are like much more open to doing that because they've been in that position themselves. So I want to get
to Mercury in a little bit, coming back to your time at Y Combinator,
sure.
I feel Mercury's it's so well freaking done. I feel like this is the part that I hate as a listener when the person's so effusive, but I would describe it, you're doing for banking what Stripe did for credit card processing. That it's just like Stripe. When Chase says to me, why don't you switch to us? And I say, I'm with Stripe. And they start saying, what's the percentage they're giving you? I realize they don't get it. It's not just the percentage, it's just that my virtual assistant can give somebody a refund in a clear way. It's that somebody can make up a form app and I could connect Stripe to it today without any headache. It's those little things that you don't understand when you're saying, what's the percentage? It's not like I can give you a clear, straight up percentage answer anyway. It's the same thing with you. What you did with Mercury was you created a reasonable experience, one that just makes it. The truth is, all I've seen is two things really well done. I saw through Ruben Gomez. He said, Andrew, you're not going to get it until you see it. He screencasted himself logging into the account, which God bless him. He trusted me. I see all his banking information. Then he goes, look, I'm about to pay this person. I do these types of payments on a regular basis, usually a pain. He fills out a form that's super clear, white screen, just a clear field that you have to enter. Payment sent out in less than 30 seconds. I thought Chase was good because I used to be with Citibank, which was awful. Chase now looks like an antiquated grandparent, you know, completely out of touch with the reality of the world as it is today. The second thing that he showed me was, he said, I also search for payments on a regular basis, or I search for transactions. And he went to search, just standard search. It pre-populates. It's just beautiful. Everything is, he found it right away. So I get it. I want to get to how you figured out that this was a thing to get into. I want to know what you're thinking about the future. I want to know how you got your first customers, especially since I've talked to dozens of your customers now. And I'm surprised you have that many raving fans, but let's spend a little bit more time investing and then get into that. Okay.
Yep.
So you help them out. And then what else do you do? Would you go when you're Y Combinator and walk with them to an investor meeting? Do you personally invest along with them?
So I guess, like, taking a step back, you know, this is 2016. I've been doing startups since 2006. So I'm like 10 years into, like, basically continuous startups. Like, I have never paused in that time. So I was basically trying to decide then, and I spent a lot of 2016 and early 2017 deciding this, is like, do I want to become a full-time investor or do I want to do another startup? Those are like kind of the two options I was weighing. So that's why I got into becoming a part-time partner, because, you know, it was something I could do while my earnout was happening and I could kind of, yeah, dabble my toes into it. And at the same time, also, yeah, the best way to learn these things is just by doing them, right? So I decided, like, I was investing very aggressively. I think I invested in like 30 companies in that first year. So that was how I was approaching this. I was kind of testing it out. Like, is this something I could see myself doing in the future? And so when it comes to YC, you know, I wouldn't say another investor should ever walk into an investor meeting with you. Like, you kind of want to give the confidence to the founders to kind of stand up for themselves and be able to kind of do these things themselves. So, you know, what you help with is things like introductions, helping them hone their pitch. You know, sometimes a little bit of like negotiations. It's like, oh, this, you know, I wanted 10 million valuation. This investor is saying 7 million. And then, you know, you as an somewhat external party can say, okay, you know, this is fair based on like what I'm seeing in the rest of the market. So you can be helpful in lots of ways, but you don't want to kind of, you know, at the end of the day, the founder has to do their own job.
How did you decide who to invest in? What were you looking for? What were you thinking of?
Yeah, I mean, these things have changed over time. I think the biggest thing for me is kind of what I want the future to be like. So often I see an investment, I'm like, oh, this might be interesting, but like, it's not like aligned with my vision of the future. So like, if you take Airtable, for example, right? I'm a power user of spreadsheets, as we touched on a second ago. But also I'm an engineer. So I'm just like, and then you, as an engineer, you make so many CRUD apps, right? Like these basic apps that do the same thing over and over. It's like you save some form, you display the form, and it's like, and so you've got these spreadsheets that are like fairly powerful, and you've got this programming, which is powerful, but there's nothing like in between, right? And this is, you know, back then, obviously, the whole no code thing wasn't really a thing. So that's, yeah, I could see that. I was like, okay, this is the future is going to be people being able to make relatively complicated apps without touching code. And Airtable, that was their vision from the start.
And it was apps that are fast. I thought that Airtable was, nobody uses databases. Mm-hmm. We're going to make a database that tricks them into using it because it's going to masquerade itself as a spreadsheet, which they're using for data anyway.
Well, I mean, engineers use databases all the time, right? So like,
but, the average person, obviously people use databases a lot, even when they don't realize it.
That's the bridge, right? Like, how do you get an average person, like, when you're manipulating data in a database as an average person, you're basically like coding, although like it doesn't feel like that, right? And like the basis of like, here's a database. That's the start of like a fully fledged app. So, I mean, actually Airtable just launched a bunch of features this week, which like build on top of that underlying database. So you start with the database and a really good like editor for it, but then you can keep layering on top of that to build actually like fairly full featured apps. So we actually launched Mercury Rays, I guess that was last week. And actually the front end for Mercury Rays is just an Airtable form. And then the back end of Mercury Rays is this gallery, which we've also built using Airtable. So we managed to like launch this like full project, which is, you know, fairly powerful, but it's all built without any programming.
See, what's Mercury Rays? What is it? It's a place if you're raising your seed round to add yourself to a list and then have investors check out your company?
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, and you've got some pretty interesting people in there. Sahil Avania, Ryan Hoover. Got it. And so they just get to see all of these different potential.
Yeah, I mean, Mercury, about 35% of Mercury users start using Mercury right after they incorporate. So we have this like really early stage startups using Mercury. And, you know, obviously I try to be helpful and talk to them and they're always asking me, hey, can you put me in touch with some seed investors all the time? And I try to do that every now and then, but obviously I can't do it for everyone. So we decided to kind of make a program to try to help these people.
I can see how this would make sense. It also feels a lot like AngelList version one, you know?
The original version.
You just put a list together and you send it out to people. Okay. So I see your vision is, this is what I'd like to see in the world. Here's someone who's creating it. I'll go and back them. But what about like Gecko Robotics? They do infrastructure inspections using robots. Is that a future that you're really eager to see? Or is it just an idea that makes sense?
Obviously, like when it comes to like industries where you're not like a deep expert in, and I was in no way a deep expert, then you have to like hear their story and say, okay, how does this work in your future? So the bits that I am passionate about is like kind of connected robots and like especially doing like dirty work, right? Like you don't want... Like before Gecko Robotics, right? If you've got an inspection to do on like a power plant, people were literally like setting up this kind of ad hoc scaffolding, climbing up the scaffolding. And there was like multiple deaths per year and people doing this. It used to take multiple days. They made a little robot that would do this inspection for you. So even though like I don't know anything about that industry and I had to like, they had to like convince me that like this is a need in the industry. It's definitely like something I was like, wow, like in 10 years, I can't imagine people are going to be climbing up the scaffolding if a robot can like climb up for you and do it in like 1/10 of the time. So it's that kind of thing, right? So it's not just you understand and sometimes you have a very specific thesis and you're like, okay, like I have this like general thesis where I'm like, I never want to go to the doctor, right? So I've ended up investing a ton of like telemedicine companies, which some of them have done well. I try to come up with like broad things of like where I think the future will be. I think robots will do most things that humans don't want to do. I think,
You know, the one that I would really like to see do better is Circle Medical. I met the founder at lunch. I started using it. They sent somebody into my office, a doctor, a real doctor into my office.
That's great, right?
What?
Yeah, it's great.
It's unbelievably great. It was kind of weird though, because I forget what it was. Maybe I thought I had a hemorrhoid or something. It was weird in the office to like take down my pants and have the doctor check me out. So that was a little bit off, but it just made so much sense because I don't want to go to the doctor. It's just a waste of time. All right. That's too much information about me. I want to ask you a little bit more about Mercury and about the Rolling Fund. You got a little more time with us?
Sure.
Good. All right. Second sponsor is a company called TopTal. Do you know anything about TopTal?
I have heard of them, but not much.
Here's what they do. They screen out developers and then they have a matcher who's like a matchmaker who just says, hey, Imad, what do you need? What kind of developer? Let's talk about your business. Do you need one person, a team of people? Is it part-time? Anyway, they have all that. And then they hook you up with a person or a few people. And if you like them, you can get started right away. If you don't, you move on. Let me ask you, instead of me doing a plug for them, do you have a tip for somebody who's looking to hire an outside developer on how to do it right? And we'll make that the ad for TopTal.
How to do it right. I think like actually having a consistent programming challenge is a good thing to have. Then you can judge like whether someone's good. One thing that's worked really well for Mercury is our backend is written in Haskell, which is like a fairly unusual programming language that's like somewhat niche, but a lot of engineers are very passionate about it. So, you know, if you can pick a tech stack that like is unique, that's a good way to differentiate as well.
Okay. I think, first of all, they do absolutely, they rock these tests. I see people go on Medium and write blog posts about how they failed the test or what they learned from it and how they want to do it again. But I think it makes sense also. You're saying in addition to that, do you recommend that somebody who's hiring from TopTal offer their own test too, their own programming test to see if the person's right fit?
It just depends on your situation, but I mean, you kind of want to compare who you're talking to like all the engineers right. you have and like other sources. You probably should, but yeah, it depends on your exact situation.
All right. If you're out there listening to me and you need to hire a developer, maybe you've got a project that's just come to mind and your team doesn't have time to focus on it. Go to TopTal and you can hire someone who's done a similar project excellently and you can do it quickly. All you have to do is go to top as in top of your head, tal as in talent, toptal.com/Mixergy. And I should tell you why you should use that /Mixergy, because if you do, they're going to give you 80 hours of developer credit when you pay for your first 80 hours in addition to a no risk trial period. All you have to do is go to toptal.com/Mixergy. The rolling fund, my concern with it was, I talked to AngelList. I said, look, I want to interview someone about this. My concern is, am I allowed to promote this? It feels like I'm going to be in trouble for promoting someone else's investment vehicle. And that person's going to be in trouble for promoting. They said, it's not an issue, right? As long as you let AngelList screen out the investors and make sure that they're accredited, meaning they have certain milestones like more than $1 million in the bank or certain, right? Then it's totally fine. And you're letting them screen it. And so you're allowed to talk about it.
Yeah.
And even raise money from here.
Yeah. It's, rolling funds are kind of interesting because they've like pulled together a bunch of these like disparate innovations into like one package that's like really resonated. There's the obviously like able to promote it to everyone aspect.
Right.
But the other bigger aspect is, you know, before you wanted to invest in a fund, like if you want to go invest in like Sequoia's fund, like number one, they won't let you do it. But number two, you probably have to put in like 500K to get in there, right? Like you can't do it with like 5K or 10K or something like that. So they've also like made the barrier to entry for LPs way smaller, because like, you can just invest in a quarter and you can invest with a small amount of money.
What's the smallest amount that you're accepting?
I accept 10K per quarter. Okay. So it's those two combined together, and the fact that it's on the AngelList platform and it's like they automatically do accreditation and all this kind of stuff. That's what's made it like actually like something you can talk about, but it's worth talking about because anyone who's listening to this, anyone who fits the accreditation status and has money and wants to invest in startups.
And the rolling part is that it's basically a subscription. They came up with the phrase rolling fund, right?
Yep.
And the idea is it's a subscription. Anyone who's interested can just put $10,000 into your fund. It would be $10,000 a quarter. In the future, it might be $10,000 a month or $10,000 per whatever period you pick. For now, a quarter is what I think the smallest period that they're allowing. And if you invest the money, then great. If you don't, it just rolls into the following quarter and you can invest the money then. Anyone who's invested can decide to continue to subscribe or cancel at any time, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then you get 20% of all the upside plus what, like a 2% management fee.
Yeah, basically.
Yeah, I nailed it.
Well, AngelList takes 5% of that 20%. So that's one.
5 percentage points?
Yeah, they take 5% of the carry.
So they get 5%, you get 15%. And the people who invested get the rest of the 80% of all the upside. How are you raising money for this? What are you doing?
I'm really busy with Mercury. So
yeah.
I love talking to entrepreneurs. I'm happy to do that. On the raising money for my rolling fund, I'm doing like the least amount of work possible. And one of the great things is that AngelList has a bunch of LPs and they have a platform and they obviously get an incentive for like promoting my fund.
That's what the 5% is. If I understand it right, they take a different percentage if they bring the investor to you versus if you say, hey, Andrew and I are friends, Andrew will invest, then it's a smaller amount that they take, much smaller.
Yeah.
Right.
Then they only take that initial fee. They take like a 1.5% fee.
Yeah.
But for me, they do most of the LP stuff because I'm just too busy to, I mean, there's a few of my friends doing it, but a lot of the LPs are bought directly by AngelList, which works out great for me because I don't want to go spend all my time like talking to LPs.
And you're also a brand and you're associated with another brand, Y Combinator. And so the combination means that anyone who buys into this world says, all right, I know Ahmad, I'll just put money in through AngelList.
Yeah, and I have a pretty good track record, so that helps as well. Back in 2016 when I was starting out, like you'd be crazy to go just give me some money to invest. But now I've done 150 companies. I have almost a 50% IRR.
50% internal rate of return.
I mean, obviously they're not liquid investments, but yeah, that's what my current kind of run rate is.
All right. Let me then move on to Mercury. I feel like I've tapped out. I'm kind of excited about the whole idea of a rolling fund. Just the concept is interesting because it's innovative, and the freaking guys at Angel is just so freaking innovative.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, they've been trying to innovate this category. Like syndicates were nothing until like Angel listed it. And then my rolling funds is a new thing. And I think it'll be bigger than everything else they've done.
You do.
Yeah.
All right. Wait, one last thing. Since you've got a bank, do you get to then have insight into how companies are doing, which then you use to make your investment decisions? I'm assuming.
I wouldn't do that. Like it feels a little unethical. And I think Mercury Raise actually is like a good way for me to do it because then a company is opting in to like share information into Mercury Raise. And yeah, I'll be one of the investors on that platform. But there's definitely like, people have to trust that they're using a bank and there's all sorts of information that like is fairly personal that goes in the bank account. So, I wouldn't like mine that data in any way. That wouldn't feel right to me.
Okay. But you, even though you don't mind it, you still get a sense of what's working in the world, where the money is, right? There's certain places where if you stand in the market, you understand how businesses are doing.
And yeah, you for get sure. A better, I mean, I can insight. See, I can see like, what our top businesses are. And actually more importantly, I'm just talking to entrepreneurs all the time, right? Like I probably speak to like 5 to 10 like customers and I try to be helpful or whatever it is like every week. So
yeah,
so
one dude said he signed up. I wish I had their names, but stinking Twitter, they're great, except when they're not. I can't go into my direct messages, which is where I wanted people to message me about Mercury because I wanted private stuff from them. Yeah. I can't go and search my private messages, my DMs in Twitter. All I could do is search for the names of the people who I talk to. So I can't get the exact name of the person, but one of the people who signed up for Mercury said, 1:58 in the morning, I had a question. He responded, Ahmad, the founder responded. He said, all right, I buy into this. And he signed up. I said, have you been disappointed? He goes, no, it's great. So let's go back to where you came up with the idea for Mercury.
Yeah, sure. So I think it goes back to that point about investing is like, where do you see the future? I've been an entrepreneur since 2006. And if you remember in 2006, all of these business tools like really sucked, right? Like you'd use Skype for like talking to your colleagues. You would, there wasn't Stripe wasn't around. When it came to payroll, you had to deal with kind of this broken stuff. So, as time went on, like these tools got better and better. And I kind of call it like consumerization of business tools happened. So by the time 2013 came along, I'm pretty good friends with the Gusto founders. So I saw their journey very closely. They took something payroll, which before that they launched, payroll was just really bad. Like I remember there was like me and Jude, we were sitting in our apartment in San Francisco and we had someone come with like freaking like literal filing binder to like make us fill out like payroll forms. I was like, how is this like the,
that's you know, happening. I had that too from ADP.
Yeah, it was ADP.
He didn't come with a piece of paper. He was so proud. He had an iPad. I look at it. It was an iPad with like a DocuSign for me to sign.
Oh, yeah, that's okay. Advanced. Like I did it right. When they came with like literally pieces of paper. Anyway, So I saw that journey where like payroll became like fully like as good as other online consumer apps, but banking just hasn't improved, right? Like we're dealing with the same kind of bad bank software where you have to go inside a branch or like deal with emails to sign up. And I was just like, in 2013, I was distinctly remember just feeling like the pain of having to deal with just talking to people who work at banks. They don't have like modern customer service kind of tools, right? Like you can't just like chat someone and get an answer and it's like relatively quick. Everything about dealing with a bank is painful. And then on top of that, they charge you fees for all sorts of things. And it's so confusing. I don't know if you've ever seen like a fee schedule for a business bank account, but it's just a complete mess. It's like,
I shouldn't interrupt, but I absolutely did this week. I was told that I needed to set up an account for like retirement for Mixergy, retirement plan. I set it up with Chase. Chase emails me the link to the thing that I have to fill out using something Voltage or something. I go, what is Voltage? I can't open it up. I have to email an email address. I take the whole message they just sent me. I forward it to an email address. And then they forward me something else that I could log in if I have the password. So I did that. And then at the end of it, I got a wire information. So this is from Chase to Chase. Okay, I'll get the wire information. I put it into their site. It literally says the price of a wire is zero to, I think, $15. I go, then how do I know? Because you'll see it on your statement. Now, am I going to go into my statement a month later to see whether it was 15 or not? And then ACH also is some price, but I thought ACH was included for free and I couldn't figure it out. And then I said, screw it, it's $15. It doesn't really matter. I'll take a screenshot in case I need to remember this moment and do something with it, but I'll move on. But yeah, I totally get what you're talking about.
Yeah. I mean, everyone has some story about some crazy stuff that the previous banks
did. Here's the thing though, Rod. It's not that big of a deal for me. So yeah, it sucks, but really, how much does it suck? $15 suck for... Yeah. And if I did it often enough, I just find the price for ACH and then I'd enroll in their ACH program at $15 a month and then I know it's all free. But how do you know it sucks that badly?
I mean, right now we're using Zoom, right? Why aren't we using Google Meet? Like, it doesn't suck that much.
No, like, it does. I couldn't use Google Meet. No, I could clearly tell you. With Google Meet, I can't get a recording of your audio separate from my audio. With Google Meet, if you have multiple people, it's very hard on certain devices to see just the person who's speaking or all the people together. Anyway, there are lots of different issues.
Yeah. So there's specific points where it sucks really bad, and then there's specific points where it just sucks quite a lot. So one thing that we've done really well with, which, you know, it's crazy that like in April 2019, this was completely new to the US, but like you couldn't set up an online business bank account before we launched in April. So for most of the big banks, the only way to set up a bank account is like walk into a branch, sit there for 3 hours, and then you get a bank account. While we were doing Mercury, we set up like 9 or 10 bank accounts to like feel the process.
Just to understand it.
Yeah.
Was there a moment when you saw this? Did you see your entrepreneurs you were backing go through this problem? Did you feel it yourself? Or were you just saying, I know that everything needs to be modernized. What's a part of the business stack that hasn't been modernized? Banking, I'll go in and I'll figure it out. Which approach was it?
So that particular pain point is something I had felt, but it's one of those things where you feel it like one off and then you're like, okay, you know, now I have a bank account that I moved on. The other things that I had felt like more distinctly at HeyZap were, number one, we couldn't get an API from our bank. So the way HeyZap would work is, you know, we would do ads things. We've had advertisers like pay us a bunch of money. We would want to then take, you know, someone paid us $50K. We would want to put that into our system. And then at the end of the month, we'd pay out 600 developers. And to do most of that with the bank, it was all manual. Like you'd have to log in every day to see who had paid you and then like enter it into your system. And then end of the month, you'd do this like crazy, like it took us like 3 or 4 days every end of the month to like pay out everyone because we were manually entering in like all of this data, making sure we don't make mistakes and all this kind of stuff. And you just can't get an API from a bank, even today, apart from Mercury. I don't think there's any other bank that has like an easy online kind of modern API that you can use. So that was a distinct pain point we felt. Other things, yeah, one thing that still kills me, and like you reminded me of it when you were talking about searching for transactions, is every bank, they only give you transactions on their dashboard for the last 3 months, and you have to go into these PDF statements to try to like get any data. And I swear to you, I thought this was like some sort of law that made it like this because it's such a consistent thing between every bank. And I investigated, there isn't a law. It's like, you know, all of these banks all use these really antiquated backend systems to run their online stuff. And all of these backend systems have this like relatively dumb restriction, which is why every bank has this restriction. So there's a lot of things you can kind of reimagine if you just approach it from like first principles, and like it's all of these frustrations add up for people, and there's no reason for it anymore, right? Like every other tool we use is modern and good. Like there's no reason why the bank has to be stuck in the past.
What about this? If you're just being a bank, which is where you are right now, where's the money coming in? It feels like my bank doesn't make any money from me, which is why they keep setting me up with different salespeople to switch my credit card processing to them, to switch my life insurance, my this, my 401k.
Sure. So the two places we make money is, number one, we give people debit cards. And when people swipe the debit card, we're the card issuer and we get 80% of the interchange, which is fairly substantial. It's for business cards, it's 1.8% or so. And then the second place is when people store money with us. The way it works is we work with a partner bank to keep the money. So the money doesn't store directly with us. That partner bank, yeah, every deposit you have as a bank has value attached to it because you can then lend out that money to other people. So they give us a rev share on those deposits. So those are the two main methods. But there's also, you know, one of the reasons, like banks always make the most of their money on lending, right? Like they have deposits, they make money on lending. But when they're not lending to you as a customer, they want to try to still kind of milk you for money, which is why like a lot of the worst experience people have with banks are like when they don't have as much money at the bank, right? Like that's when the fees go up. That's when you have like a much worse experience. And I fundamentally don't think that should be the case with banks. Like there's definitely, you know, maybe on 50% of our customers, we don't make any money or we don't make as much money as it costs us. But with the top 10% of customers, we make a ton of money. And I would much rather have like kind of like a freemium mentality to it, that like you keep your costs of service as low as possible. Like we don't have bank branches. We try to automate as many things as possible. And then you serve this kind of, you know, free tier. And the other secret is like with entrepreneurs, you know, someone can have nothing for like 6 months and then suddenly they become a huge company. So if you can support them early on when they're like zero, you can grow with them when they become bigger. And most people don't want to switch banks. So you can kind of stick with them through the journey if you're there.
So that brings me to why I'm not with you. As soon as I saw that, I said, this is solving all my problems. I feel like it's such a pain. I have to go back to Pilot, which is doing my books, and say, I've got a new bank account. I have to put in, I would want to put in a minimum of $250,000 with you guys, right? For some reason, that seems like the savings I would have on sending wires seems like it would be worth it. Oh, ACH is free no matter what. Okay. And then I have to remember which of my account is money going into, and then eventually start to wean off of Chase, you know, and remember that at some point I'm going to go below their minimum. So then it's such a pain to switch. No wonder you're going after new companies first.
Yeah. I mean, it's probably less of a pain than you think it is. You know, Pilot, we're like very well integrated too, and we have a concept of like a bookkeeper account, so you can invite your Pilot user to it. We made like, you know, saving like a new recipient super simple, so you know, both sending ACH and wires will be as easy as possible. So although it feels like a little painful and, you know, it's not trivial, it's probably not as bad as like you initially think it is. And, you know, we don't have any minimums or any of the weird stuff. So you can just try us out. And then later on, if you're like, okay, this is working out. You know, one thing that people do often is try us for like a specific use case. So maybe they don't switch over completely with us, but they might try. Like we have virtual cards, for example, which, you know, Chase probably doesn't have. So you can use us with the virtual card and have a little bit of money there and get comfortable with it and then switch over time.
I did it right now as you were answering that question. Halfway through, I said, let me try to see, because there is no downside, right? If I have another bank account, am I out anything? No, right? Okay. So I did it. I think I've got now, I had to tell you guys that I wasn't in the gambling space because you guys don't do that. You don't do anyone in weed, right?
Yeah.
But other than that, I think I'm okay.
I mean, you're almost certainly okay.
Yeah. I mean, I think I'm done here. I probably just need to give you my address and then we're done. All right. I'm into it.
Did you just do that on an iPad?
I only use my iPad. Yeah. I'm on the iPad. That's another pain in the neck. I can't do certain things on an iPad. So here, you want to know my legal business name? I do wish that it was easier to switch off from... Oh, no. Okay. I want to make sure that I don't make a mistake on this. But it seems like a pretty straightforward thing to do.
No.
That one of the things that I discovered when I was going through this was, and you told me that this would come up, people said that there was an issue with international wires or international payments. What happened there?
Yeah. We do like especially as we've grown, like, you know, we do thousands of these things a month, and people are very sensitive with money, as they should be. Obviously, when something goes wrong, people should get worked up about it. So we were previously, we were, the way it works is, international wire systems are like the most antiquated of the of the payment systems there exists. So there's this concept of like correspondent bank. I won't bore you with it, but the process was not very smooth. Both, it would take a long time. Wires would sometimes have like random fees associated to them. And people got very frustrated about that. We actually worked with that existing provider to improve the process, so now it's much smoother. And we also have a new provider that like is working out much better. But you kind of have to, especially like most of the problems people will complain about are things to do with like when you interface with these legacy systems. And yeah, especially when you're growing fast and you're trying to like, you know, for example, with like when you're sending an international wire to India, there's a special code that you need for the branch that's receiving the wire. So there's, and yeah, you get end up like, we have a ton of like per country, like things that we had to build over time. And like, you know, while we don't have it for like a few weeks, people get really mad because then the wire's not working, and yeah, and they should get mad about it. But yeah, the way we try to handle it is like, A, obviously try to get to the root cause and fix it, but B, just be like, you know, really talk to the customer. Yeah. If there's any fees they incur, we refund them. And hopefully most people appreciate that. And like, you know, and actually one of the fun things is about serving startups is if we do make mistakes, they, you know, they are very empathetic because they're like, oh yeah, you know, you guys are a startup. Like, I understand that, like, yeah, as long as you don't try to like, yeah, not admit responsibility. Like if you're like very transparent about things, people are actually like surprisingly understanding.
All right. While you were answering that, I finished everything except for the upload of documents that I should look afterwards. Now I need to show you the documents that shows that I have a DBA. Yeah. I need to upload the company formation document, which I just discovered and I took a picture of the other day, and then my EIN number, and then I'm done. And then I'm in with you guys.
Nice.
And hopefully Pilot's not going to charge me extra for another bank account. And then all I have to do now is just start transferring more of the money with you guys, and I get to experience what it's like to be on Mercury. How much did it cost you to get Mercury.com?
Oh my God. I don't know if I can, I don't even know if I'm allowed to say specifics, but so I've been working on Mercury. Mercury.com is a long story. If you, I won't bore you with it, but I've been working on it for like 2 years.
Give me a summary of it. What happened?
Basically, It was Mercury.com was this huge company called Mercury Interactive that sold, I think, for like $2.5 billion or something. It was an Israeli-based company. They sold to HP. So HP then like subsumed their product. So they stopped using the domain. But then they spun it out to HPE, which was their software division. And then HPE sold a bunch of things to Micro Focus. So this Micro Focus is a UK-based company. So that company owned Mercury.com. They weren't using it. And I just had to like persuade them to like be open to selling it, because they were like, oh, sales and marketing things that like, there's still some brand association there. And like, I was like, okay, really no one knows about it. It doesn't point to anything. Anyway, it took 2 years or something.
So how do you convince a company to sell to you? It's not like they need your money and the people on board aren't, right?
So yeah, one thing, we were funded by Andreessen Horowitz, and like, yeah, the initial intro was like straight from like Mark Andreessen, because he's on the board of HP, to HP. So that like helped facilitate a little bit and like establish credibility to some extent. And then after that, it was somewhat of like a waiting game. It was just like, can I hit them up every 3 months and say, hey, you know, let's talk about it. Oh, you know, well, so you just have to like, we just had to wait partly. So we ended up paying more than $1 million for it, but we extended it over 5 years. So the payments over 5 years, which, you know, as a startup, we also backweighted it. So like the bulk of the payment is towards the end of the 5 years. And yeah, you know, my reasoning was, and yeah, it's also been the case, like we're going to get a lot bigger in 5 years. So you know, the same dollar value will be less painful to us.
And you guys raised $26 million.
Yeah.
And then the final thing is, you're not a bank yourself, if I understand it right. You're basically working with a bank. You're the front end, right?
Yeah.
What's the bank?
The bank is called Evolve Bank and Trust. And it's a 90-year-old, or I guess now a 94-year-old bank. And the way it works, it's true for most challenger banks. So like Chime is the biggest challenger bank, and they also work with another bank. They work with Bancorp. And the way it works is the money never touches Mercury. So yeah, the tricky part is obviously banking is heavily regulated, but there's also this trust component. So if, you know, when we talk to customers, we're like, hey, we work with a 94-year-old FDIC insured bank. The money actually doesn't ever touch us. We're really like providing, you don't have to interact with that bank. We're providing all the software, the card, the customer service, all of that. But in terms of like where the money's going, like the money goes directly to that bank, and then we effectively send them like instructions to like send money back and forth.
And you have the ability to switch away from them if you need to at some point in the future. I've got a friend who I think switched away from who's running a challenger bank that switched away. It's a pain, but it's possible.
Yeah. And like once you're more mature, you might have like three backend banks that like are like appropriate for different use cases.
Damn it, dude. This is such a great idea. You nailed it with this one. I feel like HeyZap made sense. I don't fully get the gaming space. I told you I hated being in gaming. It just like even playing it sucked me in. This just feels like it makes so much freaking sense. A bank for businesses that works like the rest of the software that we use, you know, it just, everything else makes sense. And then when we go into banking, we're going back to our grandfather's world, which made sense for them, but not for us. Congratulations. All right. I got nothing else to add to this. Everyone should go check out mercury.com. It's a great domain name, great company name. I want to thank the two sponsors who made this interview happen. The first is LaunchPeer. They're your peer. Launchpeer.com/Mixergy. If you got an idea, you want help thinking it through, they will help you do it for free. Launchpeer.com/Mixergy. And the second, when you're hiring developers, you owe it to yourself to go to toptal.com/Mixergy. Mod, congratulations. Thanks so much for doing this.
Thanks for having me, Andrew.
You bet. Bye. Bye, everyone.